For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Very happy to have giving the talk tonight Adam Tinkham, who's a member of our board and the treasurer of Ancient Dragon Zen Gate.
Thanks, Tygon. Good evening, everyone. It's great to see such a full Zendo. Until this morning, I was planning on talking about Zazen or sitting meditation, but then I had another idea. And I decided to go with it. And I'm going to begin with a story that I've been wanting to share, and it seems like this is a good moment. I was visiting, for those of you that don't know, I lived at the San Francisco Zen Center, which is a residential practice community, for 2 years. Right around 1999-2000. And I had not been back there until last December. And so one afternoon, my girlfriend and I, we went into the city, and I traced some of my old steps at the Zen Center and the nearby community. And it was 6-7 o'clock, so starting to turn dark, and we were walking back to where we had parked. I thought, something seems different, something very different. And so I looked up, and I thought, oh my goodness, the freeway is gone. There's a section of freeway that they actually, if you can believe this, freeways do come down, and instead of the opposite, and they did this right near where the Zen Center is located. And it's the strangest thing in the world, because I used to walk under it almost every day going to work and coming back. And you look up and you still feel like you can almost see and hear the cars on the freeway, but they're not there. And this giant concrete structure is not there either. And in its place now, they have community gardens that go on for, as far as I could see, and it was, like I said, it was becoming dark. And then the section of San Francisco called Hayes Valley, which is where I worked, is now a much more vibrant community where there's a park where there once used to be an on and exit ramp to the freeway. And it just so happened, as we were walking through that little park, there was a school choir performing, and it was just amazing to see the difference. And incidentally, this pastry shop that I used to walk a couple miles to now had opened up one storefront right there, just hundreds of yards from the Zen Center. So the contrast was made quite an impression on me, and it got me to thinking later about freeways in my own mind, well-traveled interstate in my brain, and how could I possibly maybe deconstruct it and allow other things to flourish. So instead of talking about Zazen, I'm going to talk about Zen and relationships tonight. And last year was one that was full of change for me. Some of you may or may not know that I had a full-time job that I had been giving the majority of my energy to for 6 years, and I transitioned out of it. And then a few months after that, a woman I had been seeing for about a year asked me if I wanted to move in with her. And believe it or not, I had never lived with another person in this way. So I thought about it, and I was terrified of it, but I decided to go with it. And so in the space of just a few months, really, major change in my work, and now I'm cohabitating with someone for the first time. I'd like to offer a few disclaimers before I continue. There are many ways to go through the world, and as you've just learned, this is the first time I've lived with someone, so I'm not saying that's the way to do it. But the remainder of this talk is about my navigating this new territory for me. Since I started practicing in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, I've been to a lot of Dharma talks, and this is not a topic you hear addressed very often. So I wanted to try to take it on. We spend a lot of time not only here, but at City Center in San Francisco, and then where I was practicing in North Carolina before that. We talk a lot about Dogen, who's a 13th century monk and founder of Soto Zen in Japan. But I think that relationships are very important for all of us. And the last thing is, for those of you that living with another person and that sort of thing is old hat, I hope maybe I can offer something new to you. Or at the end, you can educate me. I would just wanted to ask, if you feel like sharing, how many people here have cohabitated before or are presently? So, okay. Thank you. So there's a lot of us here that have endeavored in this. And as I already explained, this was a big deal for me. My bachelor pad, before I moved in with Christine, is her name, I had it. It looked a lot like the Zendo, in fact. Everything was specifically chosen and very minimal. And I engaged in this process almost weekly that New Yorkers call weeding. Has anybody ever heard of that? So you go through and you look for, can I get rid of those socks? Can I get rid of that plant? You're always walking around thinking, is there something less, that I could, not have in my personal space? And I, to this day, it's a pleasurable process for me. So,
what's it called?
Weeding.
How do you spell that?
W-E-E-D. Weed, to weed. Like a garden or your bachelor pad. I took this saying from Buckminster Fuller, which is in the Steve Jobs biography that's popular right now, that sort of describes a little bit. Buckminster Fuller said, I see God in the instruments and mechanisms that work reliably. The other thing was, my bachelor pad was in a really happening neighborhood with, lots of people walking around in a cool cafe and one of the best movie theaters in the city. And I was looking at, a move no less to the suburbs, the near suburbs, but I was headed to the suburbs. And I had visited her place as well, as you might imagine, and minimalism was not the theme there. So, I was anticipating challenges with that. And then the biggest thing I had going for me for a long time was that I was out to prove that, you know, I could do life. I could do this thing on my own. I could, you know, hold down a job. I could pay my own bills. I could, you know, have my own philosophy. So one of the first conversations we had, Christine and I, she recommended a book. This is before we started dating. She recommended a book called that I brought here. It's called Against Love, A Polemic. And it's written by a professor at Northwestern who spends half the year in New York City, I guess, as well. And it's a great read. And I just wanted to pull out one particular section and share with you, and you'll see quickly what the theme of this passage is. So she says, what follows is a brief sample of answers to the simple question that she put to couples. What can't you do because you're in a couple? And then she has in parenthesis, this information is absolutely true. Nothing was invented, nothing needed to be. So here she goes. You can't leave the house without saying where you're going. You can't not say what time you'll return. You can't stay out past midnight or 11 or 10 or dinner time or not come right home after work. You can't go out when the other person feels like staying home. You can't go to parties alone. You can't go out just to go out because you can't not be considerate of the other person's worries about where you are or their natural insecurities that you're not where you should be or about where you could be instead. You can't make plans without consulting the other person, particularly not evenings and weekends, or make decisions about leisure time usage without a consultation. You can't be a slob. You can't do less than 50% around the house. Even if the other person wants to do 100 to 200% more house cleaning than you find necessary or even reasonable. You can't leave your books, tissues, shoes, makeup, mail, underwear, work, sewing stuff, or pornography lying around the house. You can't smoke in the house, or you can't leave cigarettes in cups. You can't amass more knickknacks than the other person finds tolerable. Likewise, sports paraphernalia, Fiesta ware, or Daffy Duck collectibles. You can't leave the dishes for later. Wash the dishes badly, not use soap, drink straight from the container, make crumbs without wiping them up, or load the dishwasher according to the method that seems most sensible to you. You can't use dishes directly out of the dishwasher without unloading the whole thing. You can't accumulate things that you think you just might use someday if the other person thinks you won't. You can't throw wet clothes in the laundry hamper, even though there's no logical reason not to. After all, they're going to get wet eventually. You can't have a comfortable desk because it doesn't fit the decor. You can't not notice whether the house is neat or messy. You can't not share responsibility for domestic decisions the other person has made that you've gone along with to be nice but don't really care about. You can't hire a house cleaner because your mate is a socialist and you can't live with the idea. So this goes on for another 5-6 pages of all the things you can't do. And you would think that after reading the book that... But actually, like I said, I recommend it.
Who's the author?
Laura Kipnis.
Can you repeat the title too?
Against Love. One evening here at the Dragon over tea, I had an interesting conversation with a Sangha member about a particular stumbling block in his relationship that he and his wife did resolve over time, but it was whether or not the end of the toilet paper could be over the top or in the back. And he said that that was a big one for them for a long time. But they, like I said, they did finally navigate to a solution. In Zen circles, there's a lot of talk about practice opportunities. And for me, living with another person and sharing a space has given me perhaps the most practice opportunities I've ever had. I should say that this Zen phrase, practice opportunity, is not one of my favorites. Living in a community, I heard it a lot. And if you're certain somebody has affronted you in some way, that's a practice opportunity for you. If there's noises outside the zendo during zazen, that's another practice opportunity for you. If you eat mediocre food at a restaurant, that's a practice opportunity for you. If you're in an impossibly long line at airport security, that's a practice opportunity for you. If your Zen teacher turns out to be a regular person after all, that's another practice opportunity for you. So, but I digress. Little by little, there's more space around the things that I would get hooked on or conflicted about in the living space. One example I could give is, it's not a big place, and right when you walk in, there's her work area, which is very close to the kitchen and the entrance, and it's loaded down with books and papers, etc. She's a writer. And upon my first several visits there, I just, you know, like, I could barely maintain my balance because it was just exploding with, you know, everything you can imagine, and coming from my minimal environment, this is a challenge for me. And now we share a lot of our meals near the desk, and sometimes I look over and it's still it pops out. But the good news is that little by little and moment by moment, there's more space around it. I don't have to connect a story to the desk and the papers and create an agenda that someone doesn't have and philosophize about my unofficial awareness of feng shui being the way. And that's where, for me, the parallels to zazen really come in. Because I think we all know, when we're sitting in this practice, things arise and we have a relationship with them. And over time, that relationship changes. And one thing that I try to do is let myself down more gently when I notice that, oh, I've just attached to what I'm going to do later, and I'm still thinking about it 2 minutes later. Or that someone said something earlier that bothered me, and I should have said this. So the parallels there for me between zazen and this cohabitation are, and navigating it, are very important. I think that, and also, as I said earlier, the opportunity to grow. From her book Everyday Zen, Love and Work by Charlotte Joko Beck, she said, only people who have tremendous guts can do this practice for more than a short time. And and another one, From Zen and the Art of Falling in Love, by Brenda Shoshana. In the everyday world, sitting down and not moving, not running away, just silently making acquaintance with ourselves may be considered foolish, dangerous, an indulgence even. From the point of view of Zen practice, it is considered of the utmost importance. The fundamental activity needed before we can embark upon our lives. Without time spent in this manner, our activities easily become confused, scrambled, and frantic as we seek in the external world that which exists within. So, the good news, and I feel like I've already been talking about that, about this relationship and cohabitation experiment, is that there are a lot of positives, obviously, as many of you know, from relationships. Companionship and support. Discovering that your worldview is not the only one and that it might even be flawed. Importance of compromise. Learning to trust and love. And maybe most importantly, many, many intangibles that work on a much subtler level than words can describe. From her book, Mating in Captivity, Esther Perel says, while our need for closeness is almost as basic as our need for food, it carries with it anxieties and threats that can inhibit desire. We want closeness, but not so much that we feel trapped by it. And then one of my favorite writers, Rilke, in Letters to a Young Poet, says, for one human being to love another is perhaps the most difficult task of all, the epitome, the ultimate test. Finally, what I would say in conclusion is, however these things play out in your life and romantic relationships or all relationships, I wish that you'll have clarity and strength and love. That's the end of my talk.
Thank you so much, Adam. Wonderful. So, comments, responses, questions, advice from Adam.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Adam, for a lovely talk. Very intimate sharing of your experience, practice in life. I hope Christine gets to hear this. I think she'll be touched. I also was thinking as you were speaking that romantic relationship or any relationship, children, another good example, are opportunities to practice restraint. And that the theme of this practice period I was at was studying the kind of ethics or the discipline of restraining one's attempt to get other people to behave according to how you think they can behave, essentially. And I thought you just gave a really lovely talk on that very basic bodhisattva practice that's lasts many lifetimes. So hope you enjoy it for many lifetimes.
Thank you.
So that was really, really great, Adam. It's awesome. No idea you had a girlfriend. So I kind of go on like learning these new techniques, and I just learned this new one. This one's Basil, my partner. A lot of you know he's getting ready for his defense. And so he's gone on. And we'll see for like 20 minutes in the morning real quick, you know, or something. So we email a lot. So we've been emailing, and we can kind of actually argue about learning them. But even I found tonight, because there are some issues, you know, that we've been working on taxes and that kind of stuff, and it's just like, oh, I don't want to bring it up, you know. So even though he's in the kitchen, like, cooking dinner for Anne-Marie right before I came here, I'm like, I'm going to email it. I'm going to deal with it, you know. Like, it's like, I'm dealing with it, but I don't want to, and so that was kind of interesting. But it felt good, because I felt like I still was taking care of it in a way that wouldn't cause friction right before I walked out the door, because that's no fun. But I've also found, like, not necessarily talking to my parents, but I've had really good role models from my parents with relationship-wise. My mom's a therapist, and she, you know, I hear a lot about relationships as a car and a tune-up, and I think your mom's a therapist as
well. Yeah, that's...
But just talking to, like, other people, like, people that are a little bit wiser than me, that have been in marriages for longer, and like hearing about their, like, that's so helpful for me, like, just hearing that stuff. Like, I'd love to hear about stuff like, you know, Douglas and his partner or wife and, you know, Laurel, or, you know, just different things from people's, you know, people that are wiser. It's pretty cool. But that was a great,
I'm glad you
enjoyed hearing from you on Monday evening. Awesome. But in the beginning, thank you.
Yeah. Paul?
I have a very similar situation as the one that you had. Although the difference was, instead of it being a romantic relationship, it was a roommate who I was set up with who was a female. And my aesthetic was always extremely minimalist. And her aesthetic is just clutter everywhere. And so, the first 4 or 5 months living with her, I fought it pretty hard. And even had conversations about it. But at some point, I acquiesced and I said, well, I can't change who she is. So, it's become now an apartment of clutter. I lost the battle, and, but I used to tell myself that, well, I just need to accept this, and I need to accept it, and somehow I'm growing from doing this. You know, I didn't know exactly how, but I knew somehow I was kind of growing from it. And but I like that phrase that you don't like. The practice opportunity. I think I'm going to be saying that in my head for now on. Well, this is another practice opportunity for myself. So, thank you for your time.
Yes.
And thank you for that.
Oh, sure.
And what came up for me was, do you feel that through the practice opportunity, a kind of a friendship, true friendship develops, not a kind of a romantic attachment, but a genuine respect and friendship that does it allow, do you, in your experience, does it allow for that friendship to develop?
With my girlfriend?
Yes.
Yes.
I found that talk really brought back a lot of memories. First of all, you kind of reinforced why I should go to San Francisco again. and secondly, when I heard about practice opportunity in many stages, my ex-girlfriend and myself used to fight a lot, so I would use that practice opportunity, and yeah, I think I'd get back a lot more, you know, fighting. And the practice opportunity, you have to, sometimes you can't be quiet, you can't be mindful all the time. So, you know, the practice opportunity may not work in certain areas. I don't know.
So you're saying that?
I'm saying that, I mean, it's great to have the practice opportunity, but sometimes just taking a step back and thinking while actually you have to say something can actually, you know, I don't know, can stop the conversation, or can it actually ignite the process even more. So I kind of remember, you know, where all I've used the practice opportunities in some ways. But definitely, I think San Francisco is a great city, and you actually reinforced me to go in some particular point.
One thing I try to do, and it was a really great talk. One thing that I try to do, and I don't always manage to do it, but I try, so I guess it's kind of practice. Whenever I notice something that my wife does that really annoys me, and I don't tell her, she leaves the closet in the bedroom open all the time. I try to always think to myself, I wonder how many things I do that annoy her that she doesn't tell me. Right, and I always try to catch myself, and I imagine that there are 500 things that I do that annoy her that she doesn't tell me, and it just it makes it a little bit easier to close the closet.
Well, that's a great point.
So, as you were talking, I was thinking back to when I had to get used to living alone, which is a, sort of the opposite transition, but very similar in the fears and adjustments and analysis and practice opportunities associated with it. When you're getting used to living alone, you don't think, oh, I get to drink the milk straight out of the carton. You don't look at the outside. but there are. I mean, there are wonderful things about living alone and wonderful things about living in companionship. And it's good for us to think about all of those and try to do the best that we can in whichever situation we're in. So thank you. That was
really great. Oh, you're welcome.
Oh, I wanted to say one other thing. So I have this friend, these two friends who just got married, and they decided to live in separate apartments in a two-flat, so he lives upstairs and she lives downstairs. So they thought they'd do better that way, so I don't know how that's going to work out. But people, I say that to say, people work it out whatever way they work it out, and I mean, that may change, but I thought that was an interesting choice that way. So when that way they can have clutter or not. They have different styles. Creative solutions.
I read, along those same lines, I read an article about a couple in, I think it was in New Hampshire or Maine, that had houses right across the street. Did you see that?
No, but I totally agree with it. I think it's a great idea.
And then they built a connection thing that went above the street. Yeah. Like, that's what they decided.
I think it's a good idea. Yeah, kind of, I think it's good. I have completely different ideas about when, like, when I retire than Basil does. And I'm like, all right, we're going to have completely, and we'll visit each other on the weekend. And I'm okay with that. I think it's okay because I love him, and he is my best friend. And I know that even though I want to email him, you know. I mean, there's that. So I think it's a really cool, yeah, creative way of kind of working out for a while.
I want to go back to, what's your name again?
Sanji.
Something Sanji was asking about friendship, and I think that's an important part of a relationship. And of course, there are practice opportunities living alone and practice opportunities living together. And so I met my wife after I moved here. It's about 4 years ago now, and so it's still new, but also it's wonderful companionship, and friendship is such an important part of relationship. But one thing that I think that goes back to the highway that came down and near city center is that we, when we think we know someone when we're living closely together, when we, you know, that's when it's important to actually be open to being surprised by who the person is. Real friendship is mysterious, you know, so to be willing to not know the other person, even when it feels very close and very comfortable. There's an you know, maybe you can relate to this, Dawn. There's a line in the Zen Koan commentary about the ultimate intimacy feels like enmity. So we can, you know, getting in, having conflicts, or just learning something new about your best friend, or not necessarily assuming things is another part of that practice opportunity. So I'll just throw that in there. Jim.
No particular insight, but just some additional cases. Just as Dawn suggested, I have experienced and talked very often about them. Not as often as my mates have phrased it to me. The whole the appealing side of having two separate dwelling places and just connecting, as it were, when one side or the other felt like a connection. I suspect it's very, very common. And the people, if they could afford it, would go in for that quite a bit. And the other little note, the business of the bridge going across. If I'm not mistaken, Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo had precisely that arrangement. Hmm.
So, what's the difference if somebody is having two houses as against having two rooms in the same place and they're still meeting? If they want, they can get into their room. Just trying to. The mind is playing tricks, I guess.
It's the simultaneous concurrent urges for linkage and separateness. And they're there all the time.
Well, thank you, Adam, very much for your sharing this intimate topic. And really, this is what our practice is about, is how do we take care of how we live our lives. So really much, very much appreciate it.